can I just add that there's nothing more, there could never be a more crazy bee lady sentence than
what did I say?
I need to tell the next people that move into this house to look after the bees.
To look after the bees. Oh, it's terrible. I know. That's so wrong. I had to sleep this night about my wee solitary bees.
Hopefully they're okay.
Hello, and welcome to Wildest Guys Podcast. My name's Nick Patel. I'm a birder, a conservationist, a person of colour with a big passion for passerines. This is the place where we talk birds, wildlife, and all the hard-hitting conservation topics on the top of everyone's minds right now. This week, we're talking to Katie Bell, the self-confessed queen of bees and barn owls in Northern Ireland. What Katie doesn't know about owls, solitary bees, red squirrels, pine martins, it's not worth knowing. Join me as I chat to this incredibly inspiring conservationist as we go from everything from owls being disturbed to making sure we leave plenty of room for nature in the garden. We discuss her favourite nature spots and go through even more reasons why Northern Ireland is an incredible home for nature. So sit back and enjoy. And here's your reminder to stick till the end for your weekly dose of Nature Notes of the Week, where I divulge the latest and greatest up-to-date seasonal wildlife to be on the lookout for during this week. Next week is Beetle Week. Yep, that's right, we're talking to Ash Whiffin. You all know her and love her, so join us for the next episode as we go through everything from beetles to, well, more beetles. It's going to be a cracker. Don't forget to tune in. Right, without further ado, let's get into it.
One, two.
Okay, so hello, Katie.
Hi.
Awesome to have you on. Thanks for joining. So I'd say over the last couple of years, I've sort of gained a grasp of who Katie Bell is and the sort of projects you're involved in. Obviously, there's owls, squirrels, wildflowers. But for our listeners, in just a few words, how would you describe yourself?
My goodness. Oh, can I do that in just a few words? Yeah, that's hard, isn't it? I suppose I'm a zoologist, an ecologist, and a conservation biologist, all rolled into one. I've worked on a number of different species, a lot of species groups, and I've done some sciencey stuff, some ecology, and then more recently, a lot of kind of conservation work for a number of different NGOs. That's kind of me, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that was brilliant. But it's funny, actually, because compared to some of the other people I've asked to come on the podcast, I was just looking for your Instagram and I was trying to find sort of like a hook, you know, sort of something that you were like deeply focused on. And
yeah,
it just seems like you're such an all-rounder. Like,
oh, I like
interested
everything.
Yeah, everything nature.
Yeah, that's very true. I suppose, yeah, you could kind of sum me up in that,
which is not, there's nothing
a jack
wrong
of all
with,
trades
obviously.
Yeah, jack of all trades, I suppose. And I think my my career has kind of gone that way, and I never was able to decide what to focus on because I liked everything. And I think it's been really hard because I loved the science side of it, and I loved out in the field doing research, but also kind of loved the environmental education side and the recording side and actually getting in the grip, you know, down to conservation, practical conservation. So
yeah,
I liked all of it, and I was kind of, I've got experience in all of it, and then I ended up now with the job where I get to do all of it, and it's just been kind of perfect because now I work with some big iconic species, but then on the side I kind of work with the weird species, but I get to do a mix of science and outreach and conservation. And that's kind of perfect. I've kind of found my perfect role in the sector.
Yeah. That is incredible, really, I suppose, because you've sort of tried a bit of everything and then just ended up in the perfect place, which, I suppose doesn't happen to a lot of people. So that's amazing.
No. And it's a long journey. Yeah. I mean, people that work in conservation kind of know this, that, you know, jobs aren't easy to come by. And I suppose you have to, you sometimes end up in something that's not your first choice because you just want to mm-hmm. do a job, you know, you want to do anything yeah. and you're like, I'm happy doing anything in conservation, so you yeah. take that. That's nice. It can be stressful too, but it's nice that I suppose you get to do lots of different things. And that is what happened to me, I suppose. And I kind of have all these things going on at once, which is great. But again, I feel like maybe you don't get to focus on something as much, you know. I'm really yeah. trying. Bees is definitely something I love and it's one of my main kind of passions, and I am trying to draw it in. I'm putting it in every funding application I write. I'm like, I work on these big species, but I'm like, please let me work on the little weird things, you know, one day.
Okay, that's really good, because I've actually got a little heading at the side saying bees, so
just bees. Yeah.
I was like, oh, there's, you know, there's quite a few good pictures of bees in there. She must like bees. But yeah, I think one thing I'd like to touch on first is barn owls, because it just strikes me as something you're obviously quite passionate about. And yeah, how are barn owls doing in Northern Ireland?
What an amazing bird. And I feel like I try and not pick a favorite, but it's definitely the favorite. Mm. My favorite species I work on. You can't deny how like magical a barn owl is. There's just something about them. Cool. You know, yeah. they're just amazing. But we have so few of them, so it's like such a rarity. We have about 15 pairs in the whole of Northern Ireland, so like wow. such a low number.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that small.
Yeah,
wow.
so low. Like the estimate we were working on was between 30 and 50 pairs, and that's an estimate from the 80s, and that's still what people were told. And the more and more we've kind of looked into it, and we did a bit of work with the BTO over the winter, and it's much less than that. You know, realistically, they are massively impacted by the weather. Interestingly, I suppose we're at, like, Northern Ireland is kind of like at the northerly part of their range, right? So Scotland's really like the most northerly part of their range, so
yeah,
we probably wouldn't have crazy numbers of them if everything was perfect anyway, if that makes sense. You know, we don't have the kind of Norfolk weather and landscape where there's lots of them. We also don't have native voles in Ireland. So that, you know, that's really
that's
different,
something I
right?
did not know. That's incredible. Yeah.
So it's their diet's so different and everything's so different, their ecology here, because...
So
like,
you have mice and shrews?
Yeah, we do. We have wood mice, pygmy shrew and young rats. That's the three things that make up their diet, right? So it's so different because about 75% of their diet where you are is made up of voles.
That's incredible.
So it kind of changes things quite a lot, and it changes how we will tell farmers to manage land and things, because there's a lot of the management is about creating this kind of vole-rich habitat, and a lot of that management advice is about that. And quite often farmers will read that and they'll see that and they'll come and tell us about voles, and we have to explain to them, even we don't actually have voles here, because they've read that that's what barn owls eat and they think that they're here. Now we have bank vole as an invasive species in the Republic of Ireland. It is now, there's small numbers in Northern Ireland now, and we only discovered that. We found the first record of bank vole in Northern Ireland through a barn owl pellet, which is so interesting. We found a vole skull in a barn owl pellet. It was actually a master's student of mine.
There was that one barn owl trying to find any vole that it could.
I know. So it found voles. We don't know where they came from, but that's a whole other story for another day. But yeah, so the birds in the Republic of Ireland are doing pretty well. So Birdwatch Ireland monitor them. There's quite a lot of them. Bank voles seem to be helping, but it's a complicated issue because they're invasive, right?
So are they causing issues then?
They're being monitored. What we think they're doing is they're not actually adding to like the abundance of small mammals, but they're displacing wood mice, so they're like replacing them, because our wood mice seem to not just be restricted to woods, because there's no field voles and things. Wood mice are kind of found more like bigger range, you know. And we've also got invasive greater white-tooth shrews down in the Republic of Ireland, which definitely have an impact on Pygmy Shrew. Now, we don't have those in Northern Ireland yet, but they do seem to think that that is helping the barn owl population, which is just doesn't sit too well with me, you know. So yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with that when they all start, when they spread up, because they will, and there's nothing we can do about it. But I feel like sometimes that gets away from the fact that one of the main reasons they're not here is because of land management and land use, and the fact that there's not enough nice land that supports small mammals anymore.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because I completely wasn't aware that voles weren't even in Ireland as an invasive species.
We miss a lot. We are missing a lot of things over here. It's really funny. It's all these, like, we have stoats but no weasels, and we have tree creepers but we don't have nuthatches, and it's strange, you know. There's a lot that we're missing. The voles is definitely a strange one for the ecology of our barn owls, and it also means that they eat the same thing as long-eared owls, so we don't have tawnies here. So that's another thing we don't have. So no tawny owls, right? So we actually, long-eared owls, I know, aren't really that common in England, but they're really common here. And so they're kind of, we almost think that because there's no tawnies, long-eared owls have kind of taken that space, but they both eat the same thing. They hunt in different areas, but they're both feeding, and their main food source is wood mice. So we don't know enough about that. I'm dying. I keep trying to get someone to do a PhD in long-eared owls in Ireland. I want someone to do it. People keep saying, why don't you do it? I'm like, no, please, I have enough to do. But I'm like, I really want to answer these questions and see, because some people say to us, well, I have long-eared owls here. Does that mean I won't get barn owls? You know, and I'm like, well, if the habitat's good enough, there's no reason why you shouldn't. You know, there should be enough small mammals to support both those species. And it's a good sign if you've long-eared owls, because that means there's enough small mammals, obviously, to support them.
I know in England, sometimes where there's tawnies, they can put off other species as well, can't they? Because they're quite big owl species. So how does, obviously, barn owls slightly larger than the long-ear?
I've not seen any evidence of them putting them off, because they can't. So yeah, I don't know. We don't know that. But I know lots of places where both of them hang out, and long-eared owls hunt more in cover, and barn owls are out in the open. So, and I actually, one farmer sent me a video, he told me he had short-eared owls in his farm, and I was like, think you do, but let me take a look at it. And it turned out it was two long-eared owls in a barn owl it was really weird, all hunting in this field, which is really interesting. Barn owls are just like this kind of mythical thing here that no one really sees, and there's so few of them, and everyone likes them, you know. That's they're easy to work on from that point of view. Farmers love them. People have this old relationship with them where they're like, oh, I remember there always being barn owls here, and there was always one in that building, and then they're like, oh, we knocked the building down. I'm like, no wonder why they've gone.
Barn owls, they just have that, don't they, that sort of almost mythical feel, or, you know, something which is so derived from childhood. And I think it is really important sometimes that we do have those species for conservation, you know, purposes, almost, where they do encourage people because of that association, you know, like something else that I want to come on to after, like red squirrels, you know. These sort of quotation pretty things.
Iconic is what the word they always use, right? The iconic species, you know.
Yeah, it does help, doesn't it? Barn owls are incredible, but there's nothing quite like long-eared owls, and the way they roost is just so amazing. Like, they're such a camouflage bird, and I mean, you hardly ever see them hunting anyway, because they're just so nocturnal. But if you get to see one, I presume you've seen one roosting during the day.
I mean, we get a lot of people send us in the summer. So have you heard that distinctive kind of call of the chicks? It's like, we describe it as a squeaky gate. So it's like a really loud squeak, right? And a lot of people don't know, so much of our work is kind of education and awareness of the aral species we have here, because everyone knows what a barn owl is, but not a lot of people know what a long-eared owl is for some reason. Mm-hmm. And we always get these recordings of these chicks in the summer, and people say, there's a barn owl in my garden, and it's long-eared owl chicks, and we get loads of those in the summer. And pretty much most patches of woodland you go to here, there's a breeding long-eared owl in it. Like, they're honestly everywhere. There was one down the road from me this year. I don't think anyone noticed. I was walking the dog and I was like, there's long-eared owl chicks here calling. I was like, oh no. And I like went over this tiny patch of trees and there was three chicks just hopping about in the tree. And I was just like, this is like right up the street from my house.
It's incredible.
they're class. They're really class. And I haven't been to see a huge big winter vista of them. That's something I really want to do, because I know a couple of places where there's these huge, like loads of them congregate at winter vists. I'd really love to see that. That would be really cool.
Yeah, where I grew up, we used to have a couple sort of big roosts, and they're really impressive. It's actually really fun because you sort of know how many are in the roost, but you can never really spot as many as there are. Unfortunately, quite a lot of the ones that I used to see have been displaced now, just because photographers and, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, I think there can be a lot learnt, you know, really from just how fast disappearing some of the roosts are in England anyway.
That's a bit scary, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll come on to this. I want to come on to this afterwards.
Okay.
The whole disturbance thing. I mean, it is incredibly... It's such a big topic, but it's so relevant now, especially A, post COVID, a lot more people going outside. B, photography is massive now, and 100%. The contrast between photography and wildlife watching and conservation, there's just so much of a gap between the three when they should all be together. In terms of long ears, They're incredible to see in the roost, really incredible. But obviously, you know, as you'd expect, such a fragile bird in the roost, really. Things are there for sanctuary, aren't they? So, yeah.
I know, it's a shame. And we had a bit of an issue in, it was this 2021, I think. Was that during one of the lockdowns? I can't remember now. But there was long-eared owls breeding in a Belfast park. And this was wonderful. And somebody went down and took a photo and then told everyone about it, you know. And people were coming down and just loads of photographers were coming down, to the point where the chicks died because there were so many people there constantly that the parents weren't coming to feed them. And it's just, it's just so strange to me. I'm like, how does that not... I don't know how people don't understand. And we are very, very careful about locations. We do not give away locations of owls ever because of this problem. And, you know, I work with one of our people who works in our nature reserves. He's a really good photographer. And he is just like, will never tell anyone where anything is that he photographs, you know. He tells people that need to know. But it's just scary, and I get quite a lot of messages of people wanting to photograph barn owls. You know, people like, I'd love to photograph a barn owl, can you tell me where they are? And I'm just like, no, I will not tell you where they are. You know, first of all, you need a license to even photograph a barn owl in Northern Ireland. So
really?
Anytime. Wow. You need a license to work with them and a photography license. So I need one every year if we take photos for work or whatever.
Incredible.
And which is great, it's good. How much they follow up on this, I don't know, but I think it should be that is really good that they do that, and I think it should be for more species, to be honest.
Do you have a bit of a dog issue over there, or is it not too bad at the minute?
I would say yes. This came up in a meeting we had with all of the staff, because me and a couple other members of staff brought it up, because we said we think we should say something about it, because I think we're in a position now. It came up because I was in a meeting about bird flu on Strangford Lough, and there was some issues with, you know, people worried about dogs running in to flocks of birds for a start, disturbing them, and secondly, spreading bird flu. So we got signs up and things around the lock. But I mean, on our nature reserves, we have had issues with dogs. There's Irish hare disappeared from one of our sites because of people hare coursing with dogs, things like that. We had at one of the National Trust sites that I work closely with them because they've got red squirrels. They had a dog kill a red squirrel off the lead recently, which is mad. So they've got a complete no dogs off lead policy now.
So that's not even disturbance. That's like actual just going in there and taking one out.
That's a totally different thing, isn't it? And we have red squirrels at a couple of our nature reserves. We monitor with camera traps. And last year we had an image of a cat with a red squirrel in its mouth.
Wow.
I know. So that was like, that opened the conversation, like, whose responsibility is this? Like, do we have to go around all the houses and say, like, are you aware of it? Do you know, like, it's so difficult. It's so difficult.
I suppose that's, like, one of the things with red squirrels is, like, if you want them to expand, they're going to end up in gardens and things, aren't they? You know, moving through corridors like that. So coming to all sorts of new issues with things like cats and, so moving on to squirrels anyway.
Okay.
Tell me about the red squirrels in Ireland. Let's talk red squirrels. How are red squirrels doing in Ireland? Are they doing pretty well compared to the UK, to the rest of, you know, England and Scotland and Wales?
Yeah, red squirrels are doing well. It's my one positive conservation story I can share all the time. Everything is always going to shit, excuse my language, but red squirrels, I'm like, they're doing well, and it's always nice to share some good news. They're doing well in Scotland too, but in the last decade, they have spread massively. So we survey them. We do like a countrywide survey. 2022 was one of those years, and then the last one we did was 2020. So we're still kind of looking at the results of that at the minute. But we survey for red squirrel, grey squirrel, and pine marten across the country. So we did about 200 woodlands this year or last year already. In 2022. So pine marten came out on top. Pine marten was the most recorded species of the three. Then red squirrel, then grey. So it's mad. So pine martens are everywhere. They're a massive part of this story, this three species story. We collaborated with University of Galway on an All-Ireland survey in 2019. And it was so interesting because what we saw was grey squirrels are completely gone from the areas that they were first introduced. So you guys had grey squirrels long before us, right? They were then given to some estate as a wedding present. Like six squirrels were given as a wedding present, and that's where they spread from, right? I know, isn't that
bad? That wedding ruined everything.
Ruined everything. So right in the middle of Ireland, County Longford is where they were introduced. And all those areas used to be completely grey. And they're all gone. All those greys are gone, and that's literally from pine marten. It's no human control. There are lots of areas in the country where human control protects the small fragmented populations of reds, but those huge big areas has really been pine marten. And pine marten were here, they've been here the whole time. They existed in really small numbers, mainly in the west where we have basically where all our remnants of oak woodland are. And since then, somebody started surveying them in 2014, and just they popped up everywhere on camera traps. And we were like, there are way more pine martens about than we thought there were.
And is that an issue for the reds?
So there's lots of research done about that relationship between them. It's a strange one. Pine martens are kind of like an opportunistic carnivore, right? So they're a bit lazy. They'll eat just whatever. So they eat different things through the year, and they'll eat berries and beetles and all sorts of different things. And they will eat a squirrel. They will, of course, eat a squirrel. there's two different thoughts. Reds are native, so they're like, no, a pie marten, right? They are like afraid of a pie marten, and greys aren't. So that's one of the arguments, is that they can, pie martens can kind of catch greys easier because they're like spend more time in the ground and they're a bit lazier and whatever. And then one of the other research sides has shown that greys actually, because they're not native, they are more scared of pie. It's all very strange, all very complicated, all of the research, and it's like a really interesting story, and everything we find out adds something more. But there's lots of different kind of things people think. We know that they do predate reds, so our problem is that we have lots of little pockets of red squirrels and small fragmented populations, and pine martens can have an impact on those small populations, right? And greys also can wipe out those small populations of reds. So out in the west, in Fermanagh, the whole of County Fermanagh in the west, it borders Donegal, is grey squirrel free. So it's grey squirrel free, and reds and pine martens coexist perfectly because they have enough woodland and enough space and blah, blah, blah. But the main problem is when you've got these little fragmented populations, and we still have these huge, big problems of like source populations of greys in Belfast and Dublin that are kind of keep spreading out and eking into the environment.
So when the red squirrels sort of want to expand, and then you get these little miniature sort of standalone populations, they're the ones that are getting sort of, so the big populations are sustaining themselves, but any chance of spreading?
Yeah.
I presume pine martens are doing a lot better than what they're doing over here.
Yeah, they're doing really well. I mean, they're doing well in Scotland, because we work quite closely with the UK Squirrel Accord, and we're kind of part of the four country updates, and we hear everything. And I'm always like, we've got loads of pine martens in UK, so and they're always like, can we have some? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah. But they're different genetically, so we're not even allowed to do that. So there's been a reintroduction in Wales recently, and England are soon to release their pie marten strategy. So they are in the process of writing a pie marten strategy for England. There have been releases in England as well. We haven't had to do any. They've spread all on their own. People will tell you that that's a lie. Farmers constantly tell me, you guys are throwing out pie martens, and or the National Trust throwing out pie martens, or somebody, they'll blame somebody for it, and
I'm chucking them out.
They're like, they never used to be here. I'm like, yeah, they're just doing well. I mean, it definitely is going to bring problems. It already has. They're a predator. Out in the west of the country, they kill chickens. You know, they break into chicken coops. They'll nest in people's roofs and cause all sorts of mess and noise and whatever. So I think people get a bit scared with a predator. You know, it makes me laugh. People want to live with wolves and lynx and all that, but they can't cope with a pie marten, you know. It's quite funny. Yeah. You know, they're like, there's a pie marten around. So they brought conflict with them as a predator. And they are sometimes seen as like this silver bullet to red squirrel conservation. And all the research shows that they don't make an impact on grey squirrels unless they're at a high enough density. So they cannot do that in cities. They can't do that where there's no woodland. So they can only get to high enough density in a good woodland. So part of what we came out with, a red squirrel strategy for Northern Ireland last year, and we are trying to do some kind of nature recovery network approach to this. So where we want to like join up fragmented bits of woodlands to allow reds to kind of spread naturally and blah, blah, and pine martens and whatever. And so that's like big picture what we'd like to do.
And what does that sort of involve?
I don't know yet. We've done the modeling work and all the on paper stuff. And we're hoping that that'll be kind of our future work, and we kind of improve. I think we're trying to take a new kind of nature recovery network approach to what we do. I think it's important, but with red squirrels it's quite hard, because if you create an area for red squirrels to spread, you also can cause grey squirrels to spread. So it's like case, you know, it's like case by case, almost like each area is going to be totally different to how you do it. And yeah, it's complicated, but who knows? Who knows? We don't know how it'll work in the ground yet, but.
That was an incredibly complex and detailed answer to squirrels, but it was an amazing answer as well.
Sorry.
I mean, my head's just going, like, raids, reds, pine martens,
I know.
Spreading. It's good and it's bad and it's predators, but it sounds amazing.
And it's complicated.
The main thing is it all sounds mainly positive, which, like you say, is an incredible thing. In conservation news can be so depressing at the minute, and even just, you know, working in conservation could be so difficult. It does often feel like an uphill battle, but when you get those positives, it's really helpful, isn't it? Just to get, you know, even just a few positives, but that's what makes it so rewarding, you know.
Definitely. And it's something now that, you know, when I was a kid, I don't remember going to see red squirrels, you know, like I don't remember that being a thing. And now I could easily go anywhere and see red squirrels, you know, like take people to see them. I know where they all are, kind of thing. That's just mad because I don't remember my childhood really, or it wasn't even that long ago that there's a lot of areas. I used to live in Fermanagh, and 10 years ago, all those woodlands were full of greys, and now they're full of reds and pine martens, you know, so it's just changed. It's great.
Incredible. So the red squirrels are basically just improved massively just from your work alone.
I mean, it was all me. Yeah. No, I mean, we are really lucky. There's about 14 red squirrel volunteer groups in Northern Ireland, all working in different areas, and they do so much, and they do loads of the on-the-ground work. And for some reason, red squirrels, like, people, I know why, do you know what I mean? But it's something that brings people in, and they love red squirrels. They really do. It's another one we don't have to fight to get people to like. It's more difficult to work on because of the controversial issue with grey squirrels and an invasive species and whatever. That's not nice. But people do like them. And as you say, you kind of, these iconic species bring members in and they bring money in. But really our thought is, you know, if you have a barn owl on a farm, right, there's going to be loads of other things using that farm. Like, if it's good enough for barn owls, there's going to be loads of other things. And the same, like, if you've got red squirrels in a woodland, that woodland is going to be decent enough for to support a lot of other species, you know. So we're trying to, yeah, it's not just that one thing that we work on, you know.
And I presume you do like red squirrels. They're one of your favourites.
I love a red squirrel so much.
Yeah.
You can't not like a red squirrel. Like, they're just
they're incredible.
I know. They're lovely. I don't want to say cute because we don't want to like pin animals with that word and say they're cute. But
you can't use the word cute in conservation because
then
you've got to look after Bambi and all that. And,
I know, but they're lovely. There's something really energetic and like, you know, positive about them when they're kind of jumping through the trees and things. They're just a joy to watch.
It's nice to work on things that are like that, you know, rather than just looking after somewhere that's just a fragment of habitat for a grey boring sedge or something. You know, it's nice that red squirrels are cute and lovely. But yeah, that's super interesting. And yeah, red squirrels are just...
Do you have red squirrels anywhere near you?
Not so much here. Where I grew up, we used to have red squirrels quite a bit because I wasn't too far away from Formby. You know, Formby Dunes, which they have their all... own sort of problems there because it is such an isolating place there. But then we also had the ones in the Lake District and in the middle, the Pennines, and then obviously I've seen some in Scotland as well. But it was always nicer to see the ones either in the Lakes or the Scotland than the Formby ones because, yeah, obviously I'm not going to say too much, but it did feel a lot more attraction-y, you know, because it's so enclosed and people have a day out and go see the red squirrels and they're always in the same place.
If you go
into the lakes, you've got they're in a wider area. You could go to a woodland. They might not be there. They might be there.
Yeah.
And that's for me, regardless of species, is something that I always strive for, not so much strive for, but I enjoy that a lot more. Say if, you know, there's white-tailed eagles, I'd rather go and look for them
Oh God, yeah, it's all part of the fun, right? Just like you might not see it, but you might,
So yeah, it's nice. It's one of those things that's nice. I also enjoy going to places where I can appreciate that something's there, even if I don't see it. You know, it sort of
Yeah,
adds
you know
to
it's
the.
there. You're like walking around being like, there's squirrels in here. And I mean, I've run many a red squirrel walk where I have nobody has seen a red squirrel, but you know, we will find fungi that's been nibbled by a red squirrel, or we'll find hazelnuts that have been opened, and you could show them that this one was opened by a mouse and this one was opened by a squirrel and all that. And it's just like nice to be there. You know, people are usually too loud. And I mean, I know I'm loud, but you know, chatting and you're trying to explain to people that like you actually have to be quiet and just look. And you know,
so you're walking around and doing these walks and everyone's like, where's the squirrels? And it's actually just you at the front scaring everything off.
Yeah, no, just shouting, being like, it's such a lovely day. Well, the last one we did, we saw two squirrels. So that was great. We found them. We found them. So that was lovely.
Great.
Just scampering in the trees. And yeah, it was nice.
So what would you say you prefer, red squirrels or barn owls?
Oh my goodness. That's a terrible
question.
If you
had to choose one.
Barn owls, because they're much rarer and I see them much less. And another annoying thing about barn owls in Ireland that's different is that they don't do this thing where they come out and hunt in the afternoon. Like they're like much more nocturnal.
Really?
Again,
wow.
We don't know why. It could be, we think Irish barn owls are slightly genetically different. It's all really interesting. But
are they a subspecies or they just.
I don't know.
No?
Some people would argue they're a subspecies, but not officially.
And I presume you do get winter barn owls as well.
Not that we know of.
Okay.
That's an interesting one.
Certainly on the east and south coast of England, you know, they get a few more barn owls during winter. And especially, eruption years where it's colder, whatever. But certainly not as many as like shorties and stuff. But it'd be interesting to see if any are coming over.
It'd be so interesting to know. I don't know if there's any evidence of that because we know they don't really like to fly over big bodies of water. We get short-eared owls in the winter, very few numbers of them. I think we've got really, really odd records of them breeding here. They have bred in Ireland in the past, but it's usually wintering birds and we kind of know the areas where they are.
They don't breed in Ireland at all?
Not really, no.
There's a lot of moorland, isn't there? And sort of moorland edge. You would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of bog. But it's mostly trashed. I used to work on peatlands. It's mostly trashed and in small numbers. I mean, we have decent numbers of hen harrier. Most of our breeding golden plover aren't on any of our blanket bogs anymore. All the curlews they've all moved down to kind of lowland fields. Yeah, we have about 40 pairs of hen harrier. The peatland site I used to work on had two pairs, which was amazing. But quite a lot of our hen harriers nest in second rotational forestry now, which is just weird. But they have bred on basically up the Glens of Antrim, I think, where the short-eared owls have bred in the past. But I don't want to give that away either. People will be.
No. No, it's just fascinating, really. Just I can't believe how many different things with such a, you know, familiar species. Barn owl, short-eared owl, and long-eared owl. Just incredible differences. Just probably all coming down to the food source and things like that. Yeah, that's really fascinating. On the topic of birds, would you class yourself as a bird watcher?
Oh, I mean, I'm definitely not a traditional birder. No, I didn't grow up in a birding house. My family weren't. No, they're like, but it's quite funny. I like birding was always seen as like an English thing to me, right? Isn't that weird? It was like a posh English people thing. And birding wasn't what brought me into nature. It was insects and reptiles brought me in. So I think I've become a birder. Definitely, I'm not a twitcher in any way. but I became more of a birder when, so I did wildlife tour guiding for a year in the Highlands of Scotland. And I think that definitely made me more of a birder. And I now live on Strangford Loch, and I find myself going out to look at birds. Oh my goodness. So yeah, I definitely do it more.
You're a birder.
I do. I suppose now I am, but I wasn't one of these people. You know, a lot of people birding is their start point, right? And it brings them into it, but I didn't have that way for me.
Do you have any reptiles in Northern Ireland?
We have common lizards, that's it.
So it was common lizards which brought you into it?
No, I suppose probably exotic things, I don't want to say that.
Right.
My nursery school had a snake, and it's one of my first memories at 3 years old, and I was fascinated by the snake, absolutely fascinated by the thing. And I remember, my mum remembers it, she remembers her teacher being like, I can't get Katie away from that snake. And I was just like, what is this thing? Like, this is just amazing to me.
Yeah.
And then watched a lot of things on TV with reptiles in them. And kind of, it was always my mission to work on reptiles and amphibians, is my thing. So I when I did my master's in 2012, I was like, I am going to do a project on reptiles and amphibians. And I went to Madagascar and did a project on reptiles, amphibians and reforestation.
Wow.
And that was like my dream, to do my own like research there. I'd always wanted to go. I went as a volunteer and then went back during my master's. And I'm living in the wrong country. And it was unreal. I discovered a new species of frog in like a little patch of fragmented woodland, a tiny little pygmy frog the size of my fingernail.
What did you call it?
It's not named yet because it doesn't have... I know! It's in the Stumpia genus, so we have the genus of it, and it's going to be named after the area, but it needs its song recorded before it can be like... officially recorded, and no one's been able to do that yet, so I don't even know if it's still out there. I don't know. I loved it. I've always wanted to work with that, and when I was in Scotland we did a lot of kind of stuff with slow worms and everything. But yeah, I've never got a job working with reptiles and amphibians, but one of these days. I'm definitely in the wrong country. It makes me so sad that we don't have adders or grass snakes or anything. It's just like, oh god, I would die. Yeah. I think I would just not be ever indoors if we had a load of reptiles.
Yeah. Growing up in Lancashire, we had plenty of reptiles, but not the same volumes as in the south, and certainly not grass snakes and that sort of thing. But now I've moved to Somerset, and in the Mendips particularly, where adders are common. Common.
No. So
and, exciting. And just... I honestly cannot wait for those first warm March days just to get check-in everywhere.
Please send me pictures, please. I'll live through
it. Similar to you, I grew up with like television around reptiles and things, you know, things like even, you know, crocodile hunters and stuff like that, where in a way it was that sort of exotic feel which made them seem so appealing. But I even feel that with native reptiles as well. You know,
should they be here or something?
And people still think, don't they? They think, oh, you know, we don't have lizards or whatever.
Yeah.
And you get lizards popping out at the end of February sometimes, and they are a very British thing, really. They're just incredible. It does feel like an anomaly to British wildlife, but
It's weird, right? I know. Yeah. I do love a common lizard. I do love them. And I'm glad we have them to make up for it. We don't have toads. We have frogs, no toads. We only have smooth newts. We only have one species of newt, which is smooth newt.
Right.
As well. That's, so we don't, I know we don't have great crescent newt or anything.
That's a very sad little number.
I know, stop.
could you not Is there not, calls for introductions, or is the food source not really there, or
Yeah, no, I mean, there is, but I think they've never been native here. Technically, there's loads of arguments about this, about what's actually native to Ireland and what's not. And in the UK, people argue with me that hedgehogs aren't native, and I work on hedgehogs, and I'm like, this, it's so complicated. Like, how far back do you go here? But yeah, it's a difficult one. If anyone wants to start a reintroduction, come speak to me. I'll do it, no problem. Any day, you can put adders in my garden. I'll be happy.
I'll send them in the post.
Yeah, thanks.
So you've got, a few reptiles and a couple of amphibians. Would you say that would do you feel like Northern Ireland is lacking in wildlife, or is it for its size, it has the right amount of wildlife for it, does it feel like wildlife's not really doing well enough there, or how's it feel? Does it feel conservation's going in the right direction?
I feel like wildlife's not doing well enough anywhere, right? I don't think
No,
we
it's not.
can, yeah. So I don't think I can say that at all. Like, wherever point we want to go back to, we don't have enough of anything, I would say. But I do kind of feel, I don't think I ever thought I would work here. I never thought I would work in conservation Northern Ireland. I didn't think there was enough. Even like, as a young person, I didn't think there was enough here. And I think it's really important to me now that I'm helping conserve stuff in the country I grew up in. Like, I feel like that's quite important to me now, that I'm telling people about it. And even though you think there's still so much that I haven't seen, or that I want, when you get into it, really, there's so much. And there's a point where you try and see things every year and you don't have time. Like this year, or well, last year, 2022, like, normally I try and see marsh fritillary every year, and I try and see Irish damselfly and some of those like special species. And like last year I didn't get to, and I always see them, and I was so busy I didn't get to, and things like that, that I'm like, there's still so much that I haven't seen, or haven't seen that year. That, yeah, there'll always be lots of things. Like, marsh frit is a good one. We have quite a stronghold for marsh frit in Northern Ireland, so there's quite good numbers of marsh fritillary.
Marsh fritillaries are just, they don't even look real. They're like a painting. They're so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, they're fab. I love them. I really do. I got to work on them quite a lot in my last job. Yeah, marsh frit are a good one.
What you were saying about seeing something some years and then not seeing them. It's funny how nature's calendar really does that to you. You might have had the most amazing views of something last year, and you still want to see it again next year. It's just one of those
I
things where
know.
you just feel hooked, don't you? On the topic of butterflies, I know that
Yes.
one place that you sort of have noticed quite a few pictures that you've visited the Burren quite a few times, and that seems like a really interesting place. That's not Northern Ireland though, is it? That's
No,
in Ireland.
it's the
No.
Republic of Ireland, yeah.
But the habitat is very similar to some of the stuff we have in England and in the Northwest.
Yes.
But it just looks incredible. Plants and insects and all sorts.
Oh, it is like, yeah, we were saying we were trying to go like once a year. It's like our holiday to try and go to the Burren. And quite often, why you see photographs, the only time that I have time to take any photographs, properly sit and do it, but it's such a cool place. It's really interesting. It's like an ecologist's dream, because it's this real anomaly. And it's like limestone pavement, but it has all these alpine remnants there. So it's got all this like alpine flora. And it's just so interesting. And there's just so many things that you can only see in the Burren that you can't see anywhere else. So if you like insects, there's so many things that I think I've been about four times now, and there's species of bee I'm still trying to see, and I haven't seen them yet, and I'm like, really trying. But yeah, some real special things are down there. Orchids and like transparent burnet, I've seen a couple of times when going. It's the only place in the country where you get it. And just, yeah, some just really cool things.
That's amazing. So let's talk about bees. Tell me about bees. Tell me about bees in Ireland.
Oh, bees. I love bees. I don't shut up about bees. I swear. Though, yeah, it's like my side thing. Every time something comes in about bees, I'm like, I'll answer it. I'll do it. And like, you know, please pay me to talk about bees more. Well, I don't know why. What it is that attracted me to bees? I love bees. Bumblebees were one of my like first loves, I think, as well. And I just like find them so fascinating. And when you start to find out how many different types there are, and all and everything, I was just like, these are just So we have far fewer species than you. Mm-hmm. We have 99 species of bee in Ireland. So 99, one honeybee, 21 bumblebees, and the rest solitary bees. I think I've got that right. I think it's 21 or 22. I can't remember, because we only recently had tree bumblebee. So tree bumblebee only came over in 2018 for the first time. Nobody knows where it came from. It was a weird one. And I've only seen one of them in Northern Ireland, which is mad. And they're like really common, but they're not for us. And they appeared in like Dublin and then Belfast. So they're like round Belfast and like urban areas.
So does that not sort of lead to you thinking they came on a boat?
Maybe they did. I don't know. they could. So, you know, they could have just, someone could have been coming over and a little tree bumblebee was there. On a wee holiday, like, welcome to Ireland. I don't know. But yeah, that's a new one. And I think always looking out for things arriving. So there's definitely, I mean, climate change is going to change. It's massively changing our insect species, right? So that kind of, there's already a bit of a list of things that might turn up. So that ivy bees, you know, the solitary bee, they've just turned up for the first time last year. We didn't have those either. Someone's recorded violet carpenter bee. Way down south. So I think that's something that's gonna arrive at some point.
It's incredible.
It's mad, isn't it? It's mad. But bees are great.
I can feel the enthusiasm. I just, you know, I would be the same if someone got me talking about warblers. Like, yeah, I'd be the same.
Do you love warblers, Nick? Tell us about warblers.
Warblers? What do you want to know about warblers? Honestly, how many hours do you have? but that's incredible that the number is so much lower than the rest of England. Like, because what, England has at least a couple, few hundred types of bees.
Yeah, you've got more. It could be 250 or something, I think, the full number. So you've got like double the bees we have now. I mean, I still haven't seen any of them. It's still a crazy like number to have seen all of those 99 bees. One day maybe I will. But it's still an unreachable target, you know. Yeah. So there's enough, you know, there's enough to keep me busy. But always,
you're just going to be that sort of, you're going to be that crazy person walking around. Like, I need the extra bee. I know.
I've seen 98 of these species. I had so many solitary bees in my last house. And when I moved house, it kind of like broke my heart to be like, who's going to look after all these bees? And I brought some of my bee hotels with me. And it was like, when I moved and new things popped up this year and things appeared, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, whenever a solitary bee appears and settles in your bee house, it's just like the best feeling. So that's nice, because we always have a garden list, and I'm sure you do that too, and you record what's been in your garden. And that's a really important one for me, especially because solitary bees don't forage that far from where they nest, compared to bumblebees have a much more kind of a bigger range, don't they? Solitary bees kind of, if they're there, they're there. So you can watch them quite a lot, like the leaf cutters and things. They like have a really small range, like around their little nest. So that is so nice, just being able to watch them and record what's turned up and everything. And they're more efficient pollinators. And I think quite often I get into this conversation with people because there's this weird thing where, I don't know if it's just the way it's being portrayed or because people don't understand the relationship, but when you talk about saving bees and looking after bees, people talk about honeybees quite a lot. They bring honeybees into the conversation, right? And we're like, no, but honeybees aren't in trouble. You know, they're not. And we come up with this issue where people get into bees and they have honeybees, and which can become a problem where they actually displace native bees. So trying to explain to people that like a red mason bee, for example, like can pollinate the same as like 250 honeybees, one red mason bee, and things like that. Like they're much more efficient pollinators, the way they're designed and everything. So trying to explain to people that like maybe just having some bare earth or all these different things you can do for solitary bees that isn't as well a bee box too, because they only support like maybe two species out of these like 100 species that we have. There's a gap here for me to tell people about bees.
The honeybee stuff, it's just like another form of greenwashing, really, isn't it? Like,
yeah, I think
there's so many companies out there trying to sell things that are honey related and trying to emphasize that, you know, doing their bit for honeybees is enough. And
yes, and just, they're saving the planet almost by having honeybees. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I just add that there's nothing more. There could never be a more crazy bee lady sentence than
what did I say?
I need to tell the next people that move into this house to look after the bees.
To look after the bees. Oh, it's terrible. I know. That's so wrong. I had sleepless nights about my wee solitary bees.
Thankfully, they're okay.
I know. It was actually a friend of mine's sister that bought the house, and I had a conversation with her, being like, can you explain to your sister about like the leaf cutters that visit and like the ashy mining bees that are like in this like little bit cleared bit I've got and stuff? And she was just like, I don't know if she'll listen to that. And I was like, please.
That is absolutely brilliant.
Oh dear.
Honestly, it takes crazy people to work in conservation, so take it as a compliment. I think it'd be nice to talk about your fairly in the media quite a bit, really, in a way. You seem to take part in quite a few sort of television type things. Do you think that's quite important for conservation, especially in terms of getting to all different audiences and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, the charity pimps me out to the TV, let's just say that. They want someone on there. I think quite often they like to have a female voice because that's maybe a bit of a minority. So they get men all the time. So they're like, please, we don't need a female voice for this.
Yeah.
They like having someone local with a local accent as well. So I do end up doing a lot of it. I enjoy it. It's really fun. I like it. I think there is a place for it. I think it's complicated, isn't it? Because sometimes, I don't know, sometimes some of the things on the TV aren't right, you know. We get that sometimes. I don't know how much I want to say, but you know, sometimes you're watching things around nature, maybe don't have the right people, or they don't explain it in a certain way. You know, so I think it's important to reach certain audiences. I think for people like us, it's like you're preaching to the converted, and maybe we don't need that now, you know, sometimes. But I think it opens up nature to a whole different audience. I think it's important from my point of view to show that we have nature locally, and I think that's really good. And quite often people will always say that to me. They're like, oh, I didn't know we had this or we had that or blah blah blah. I think from that point of view, it's important. I don't know, what do you think?
I think you're really good at it, and I think it's really important, because it needs to be more and more of that sort of thing, because that's the sort of, you know, demographics that aren't reaching out to conservation as much as they should have. But also, I can't really say this, but I potentially sometimes it's the wrong people doing stuff. And I think you just sort of fit in there really well, and you should do more of that, because it is really good. And it just seems really natural and like a voice that people could listen to, and that's what you want, really. And I think so much in conservation in terms of media now is, you know, trying to make a name for yourself, or the sort of like love me type thing. But when people like yourself do media stuff, it's more educational, and it's more reaching out to people for a purpose rather than just for themselves, which is really important.
Yeah, it's a whole different culture now, right? It's a strange one. It is. It's different, and people like, yeah, social media is a strange one, and I don't think I could like do. I don't know, the people that do just do that. I find it really. I don't know. It's a really strange one, and like I will happily. I don't want to talk about me. I'll happily talk about anything, you know, any animal you want me to talk about, I'll talk to you about that. One of the shows I did, she started talking, she was trying to make it personal with me, and she started like talking to me, asking me all these questions. I was like, no, I was like, this isn't about me. I'm like, this is weird. Yeah, I'm like, please. Like I had to shut her down and be like, no, and, like I'm here to talk about squirrels. Like that's it.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah. But yeah, no, I think it's really boring. Would you class yourself as a campaigner? Do you campaign?
Probably not. I mean, no. not that I don't want to be. I feel like I suppose there's only so much time I have. I'm not against it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not against it. And if something's really important, I'll like promote it.
But this is what's really interesting, because I've, you know, it's your version of conservation is so it's very not local based, but it's very specific to your area, and it's hard hitting conservation there, which is amazing, because other people I'm talking to are attacking conservation from a completely different angle. So it's, you know, not the main thing is not everyone has to do the same thing. You know, we're all trying to hit the same target in just in different ways. And in a way, campaigning for you is just on the ground more. And that's amazing.
Yeah, I think that I just I'm getting on with the work, if you know what I mean. I'm doing that and trying to promote things and almost trying to get people to support all these different people doing this good work. And I mean, we campaign as a charity. Like I work for the Wildlife Trust in Northern Ireland, and we will campaign as a charity on big things that are important to us. Like we specifically opposed the badger cull. You know, we spent a lot of time on that, and I get involved in that quite a lot. But yeah, it's hard sometimes. And I mean, we do talk quite a lot about climate change, and we attend things and shout about it, you know, and try and make people aware. But yeah, it's hard, isn't it? There's so much going on. And I mean, well, I have
personally, what are you most passionate about conservation wise, regardless of work, or what sort of drives you in conservation?
It could be
like certain species or the decline of wildlife in a certain area, or climate change stuff.
My goodness, I don't know all of it. See, here I come back to like all of it. I love all of it.
The bees.
Yeah, the bees. It's all about the bees. I suppose like when you kind of do something, it's hard to explain. I suppose when you can like see your own impact, and you know that you're actually doing something that makes some bit of a difference, whether that's like you've created a bit of habitat and a species has appeared, or you've, you know, put up a barn owl box and there's a pair of barn owls breeding in it, or you know, you've spoken to a farmer and he's changed his land management because of what you've said, that kind of thing. I suppose just that kind of actually seeing something be done, because you get to a point where you're like, you know, it's not easy, it's not always like we can't fix everything, you know, there's so many different things going on here. Like as I say, like I can go out and talk to farmers, right, and they can make all the change they want, they can do everything right, but then it's a really bad weather and the birds can't breed, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So you can't control everything. So I think being able to like see the things you can control and make a difference. The
small things.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah, I mean, it can be incredibly overwhelming if you start to think, you know, this is on my shoulders. What are some of the ways that you, you know, avoid that, like, or deal with that? Because, you know, biodiversity crisis affects everyone. It can be quite negative when you start to think about it a lot. Is it certain ways that you sort of try and work around that, or is it literally just the little wins which sort of push you?
Yeah, the little wins, and I suppose just, it's funny because I suppose when you work in conservation, sometimes it's like all-consuming, isn't it? Because it's like your passion and what you do in your free time and also what you do in your day job.
Yeah.
So it's like, and I suppose I have like other jobs too, and I volunteer, I do consultancy, but also I sit on the committee for Butterfly Conservation Northern Ireland, and I do volunteer and I do like bee walks and other volunteering. So it's almost like it takes up everything of your life. Do you know what I mean? It's really strange.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, it's your passion and your job, and sometimes it can be a bit overwhelming, and I sometimes do like to separate it, like go, and it's silly how like switching off from my nature job is to go and see nature, like different nature, you know. And I think being able to go and have like peaceful nature moments where I can enjoy nature and it's not my job, that's terrible, because people always say to me, you're so lucky, you're working with these things, and I'm like, I am, I know that, but also, you know, it's hard, and farmers shout at me and people don't do, and you go there and land is absolutely crap and people ask you for a burner box and you're like, your land is completely trash, and I deal with this, you know, all the time, and you're like, it's depressing, it gets really depressing. Yeah. So I think, yeah, going and seeing nature in a different angle. It's just going and seeing.
I know exactly what you mean. Burden for me is that is the answer for me. Yeah. What sort of conservation message would you give a random person? If you stop someone in the street and you wanted to not convert them, but send them home with a bit of a message, how would you improve their view, their mindset in terms of conservation?
That's really hard. I try and do this a lot, but with work, I mean, we talk to so many different audiences, from like primary school kids to like government to farmers to whatever. I think making people understand, well, I don't know, this is hard, right? I was in this recent course where we were talking about how to communicate the climate and biodiversity crisis, right, which is so interesting, and it was, they were telling us all these figures about people in the UK and that how they, everyone's more concerned, but that hasn't translated to action. So they're like, everyone's way more concerned with all this news, but no one's actually really doing anything, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's trying to get people to understand that their actions matter, you know, and what they do matters. And all these little things, like letting their dog run and disturb, you know, waiters or like going, just little things that, like, you know, helping people understand that that's actually not a great thing to be doing. And you could make a massive difference by doing this. Or, you know, like if you just like manage your hideous lawn slightly differently, you can make like a massive difference. You know what I mean? Like just everyone can do something. And we had a big campaign about gardens recently, which I think I'm going to be taking up again next year, and just how the impact of what people can do in their gardens is insane. Like all of our gardens combined are bigger than all of the nature reserves we have.
It's massive in the UK in general. It's just huge. And people need to treat them like nature reserves, really. You know, their own mini nature reserves.
Yeah. I know, when you have insane. It, like, and like all this plastic grass and ugh, nonsense, you know. And I just don't think, people don't know. A lot of the people I speak to, they just don't know. And you wonder why, you know, like we're so involved in it. It makes so much sense to us. Like we know it. And then I can't understand why other people don't know it sometimes, you know, when you talk to them and you're like, you know. So I think sometimes stripping right back and just helping people understand. Yeah. It's so important.
Yeah, and just telling them that it's so important that when they move house, they need to make sure that the bees are looked after by the next tenants.
That might be a bit much, but yes, I'll go visit and I'll be knocking on their door at some point and be like, can I visit the bees? Yeah. I know it's me. Yeah. Don't worry, I've been called worse. Crazy bee lady, the owl lady, the squirrel lady. I mean, you know, I'll get it all, don't worry.
No, that's brilliant. Okay, so what is your favourite place to visit for wildlife? Anywhere. One place, and you just either love it for the habitats or how it looks or the wildlife, the specific wildlife that you see there. It can be anywhere.
It has to be the Burren. It does have to be the Burren. It is. I have to
Yeah.
go for somewhere Irish. I would say Madagascar's over there somewhere for an exotic place because it's just unreal.
Yeah.
And it means a lot to me. But yeah, the Burren is like an Irish place. And also, Father Ted was filmed at the Burren, right? So
Really?
that Father Ted's house is in the Burren. It's so funny. You're going along in all these wee places, and on the map, it's like Father Ted's parochial house comes up on the map. I absolutely love it. So you can go and
Brilliant.
see Father Ted's house, and you can see all this amazing
Wow.
wildlife. Yeah, I mean, I see something different every time I go there. Depending on the
Yeah.
time of year, do you know one? You know, I might be going to see like fly orchid, or I might be going to see like small parboiled fritillary or whatever. Every time I go, there's something different, and it's class. Yeah, it's a good
Yeah.
spot.
Fly orchid are so tiny and
Oh my God, yeah.
they actually hurt my eyes. Because
Dad
you know
has
when you
seen
have to look
them
too
either.
close, and
Oh.
but it's worth it because they're just so beautiful, aren't they? And
They're
they're
so
yeah,
cool. They're
incredible.
really cool. They are, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only
Yeah.
place I've seen them, the Burren. Only place I've seen them.
Yeah, I mean they're so small.
I know.
It might be on your road. Yeah. But yeah, good answer. That
Do
is
you
one
have a
place I'd love to
favorite
go.
place?
Do I have a favorite place?
Yes.
Yeah. I would have to say
So family.
Flamborough Head.
Okay, where's that?
It's on the east coast of Yorkshire.
Okay.
And it's like chalk cliffs. And but it's not the cliffs particularly which make it amazing. It is amazing for migrant birds in spring and autumn. And you know, it's just got that sort of, you know, when you think of birds coming across the sea
Yeah.
and hitting the shore, you can actually see that happening there. It's
That's
like
cool.
migration in action, and it's really cool. You can see like a short-eared owl literally coming in off the North
Oh,
Sea
wow.
and
Okay.
landing on the first post it comes across. And
Wow.
yeah, that is just it's just an awesome place.
What about butterflies? Are there nice butterflies on the top there or not?
No. No, if I was to choose a butterfly place, it would be a place called Strawberry Bank, which is in Gloucestershire and has marsh fritillaries.
Oh, nice. Okay.
But it's just a particularly beautiful place, and yeah, marsh fritillaries are just awesome. They're just so cool. Okay, one last question.
Ooh.
One species that you wish Northern Ireland had. And this is
Hmm.
something that you've maybe never seen, and or maybe you have seen it, but you wish there was a population of them.
Oh my goodness, so many.
Adder?
I know adder was the first thing that came to my head. There are so many insects that I would want, like so many of the butterflies that we don't have, and the bees, just lots of things, but adder would be one. I mean, I've only seen like two adders in my life. Like one of them, I spent 2 months in Swedish Lapland working on Siberian jays.
Wow.
It was unreal for
Oh,
a university.
Siberian jays. Oh, what a
Yeah.
bird.
I know. So for a University of Zurich, so I was there, and then we were trekking up a hill, and there was like an adder, a little bit of melted snow, and there was an adder like in the middle of it, and I was just like, oh
Wow.
my gosh. And I also saw a lynx print in the snow that day, so that was an
Wow.
epic day. But yeah, Siberian jays, cool bird. But adder would probably have to be it because, yeah, I mean, other people might not be happy about
No,
that,
I mean that they are stunning. They're incredibly misunderstood. I think they have such a bad rep, particularly in England. And you know, they're so harmless. I mean, I do have a friend who was bitten by one and he was in hospital for over a week. But
okay.
they are harmless as
But
in,
you'll
you
be
know,
fine, yeah.
they don't seek out people and they're so nice. Yeah, good
There's
answer.
one bird which I have never seen, which is a little owl, which you don't have, and I would really love. There's something really like, I don't know, they don't look real to me, and I've still never seen one. And yeah, that's something that would be quite special for me to see, I think.
And do you have them?
Oh, no, they're not
No, so
here.
it's No, okay. So, yeah, you know, they're technically an introduced species even here, but they're so naturalized now. And they are as small as they look, you know, they're like, yeah, thrush sized. And they've got such a character because they're one of those species which they're not tame, but they'll watch you and just sort of keep an eye on you. And yeah, they've just got that sort of mysterious old man look about them. And yeah, they're really cool. So that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see them. That'd be good.
Yeah, I think you'd need to bring some across. I'm not sure they'd be able to fly across.
Yeah, no, they're so tiny. I need a little birding trip in England. I spent 2 months in Norfolk, right? I was doing bat work for the University of Bristol, but it was all at night and I had like one day off in the middle. So I was there all night. So many things I missed. There was barn owls everywhere. It was amazing. I saw nightjar when I was there. It was unreal, but like I miss so much, and I've always said that I'd love to go back, like, and properly explore, like in the daytime, and go to all these areas of England.
We're really lucky here because we have at least two tawnies calling outside the bedroom window every night. And we have a barn owl which hunts just behind the back garden.
My
And
goodness, that's
we
just
have
like mind blowing to me that there's like a barn owl in your garden. Like, that's just insane. There's about five people in this country have that.
it's just incredible the difference. But yeah, we also have little owl just down the road as well.
Oh,
So we're not
stop.
doing too badly. And I think, yeah, tawnies are great, but you just never really see them. So the barn owls are just awesome.
I saw a few tawnies in Scotland now when I worked there. They're cool. They are cool. The chicks just look really stupid, don't they? They're like so fluffy, like out in the trees. They're like,
But yeah, so we've sort of rounded it up on the topic we started with, which is awesome.
Sorry.
No, it's amazing, really. And I now know that anytime I move house, I need to make sure that the people moving in have the correct protocol in place to look after my mining bees.
Yes, leave them a list. They'll love it.
So thank you very much for coming on, and it's been super interesting. And yeah, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It was really fun.
You're welcome. And here's part two of Nature Notes for this week. The second part of this week, I want you to immerse yourself in those super early first spring appearances, in particular the species which emerge slowly from the long sleep of hibernation. First, insects. Keep your eyes peeled for emergent hibernating butterflies. Whilst it's still winter, warm, mild, blue sky days in February always bring out the first peacock, tortoiseshell, red admiral, comet, and brimstone butterflies, with many choosing to stay out and about towards the end of the month. These beautiful large butterflies basking in the warm winter apricity alongside early hoverflies and queen bumblebees. From mid-February, if we see mild enough days, the first reptiles can often make an appearance. British reptiles don't truly hibernate, more just go into a state of dormancy. So if it's warm enough and frost-free, keep tabs on those dry stone walls and sunny heathlands for any early active reptiles like the adder. February is great for the first blooming wildflowers too, the likes of lesser celandine, dog's mercury, red dead nettle, and dandelion. But my main target for the second part of the week is our emerging amphibians. Mid-February, usually around Valentine's, is key for frogs and newts becoming active again in our ponds, with many spawning by the end of the month. So watch out at night for any amphibians leaving their winter hibernaculum and heading to ponds. The species of the week to see is the smooth or common newt. If you have a garden pond, check it out at night with a low intensity torch to see if you have any out yet. Good luck, guys. I hope you see some early signs of spring. And don't forget, we're merely a fortnight away from those first wheatears hitting our shores. Oh, it's exciting. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Wilder Skies.